only rationalizing things, but I like to think I'm doing some good here. And to be honest, living here beats the alternative.
What about Jess?
She would...
Kincaid chose his words with care.
Change a few things. Like she said, the price for us being left alone is a bit steep. People are scared, though. No one wants to make waves, especially not now. You live long enough, comes a time when it's easier to just go along to get along. I agree with her in principle, but I'm not sure we can afford the alternative.
Meaning what? That these old people were tired out? That they were looking to people like Chris? Her?
Maybe.
If Rule was owned by the Council, but a Jaeger was always the final arbiter, then Jess would press Chris, hoping that Chris would command the respect that his grandfather did. But to change what?
Why can't Jess say something, or get together a committee, or whatever?
Kincaid looked like he'd sucked on a lemon.
No power. Majority rules, and the majority's with the Council and the Rev.
Yeah, meaning majority men. Are you with Reverend Jaeger?
I'm not against him on principle. I see the logic of it. If we're going to survive this, we need to maintain order. I disagree with the execution.
And adults say we're evasive.
So change it.
Not as simple as you think, kiddo. Besides, it's one thing to criticize. It's another to have a better idea. I don't know that I do. Even if I did, I'm not the man for that.
But Chris is?
She shook her head.
Lena was right. Why are you waiting around for us to clean up your mess? You guys are cowards.
Yep, said Kincaid. That's fair. One thing I gotta know, said Kincaid.
He threw the Appaloosa's reins over its head.
What happened between you and the Rev? After he threw me out, that is.
She remembered Ernst's admonition. Some secrets are best kept behind closed doors.
Why?
Alex, I've seen a lot of Spared with the Rev, and this is the first time I ever saw a Spared nail it. You knew what was going on with him.
I just guessed.
Bull. How did you know? Only me and the Council and a couple others know about him and that touch thing he's got going.
Well, I guess it was the only thing that made sense.
Don't give me that crap. Look, I'm not the enemy here. I just want to understand what's going on.
Weren't you the one who just told me to watch my mouth around the wrong people?
Yes, but in case you haven't noticed, I'm one of those right people.
Kincaid's eyes shifted toward the house. Alex followed his gaze and saw Jess staring from a window. When she saw them looking, the older woman inclined her head in a small nod, then twitched the curtains closed. Kincaid said,
"You trust me?"
Despite what Ernst had said, she trusted Kincaid about as much as she trusted anyone in this place, maybe because his scent reminded her so much of her father. During their conversation, that smell had not changed. There was none of the bite she associated with a lie, and he seemed to be going out of his way to help her. So she said,
"I guess."
"Then trust me now. How did you know about his, well, I call it a super sense? His is touch. And yours?"
She licked her lips.
"I smelled him."
Kincaid's eyebrows crawled for his hairline.
"Smell? As in a scent?"
She nodded.
"It was the same way I figured out that Harlan was there. Harlan has... had a certain scent I recognized."
"You saying Jaeger has a scent? You smell him?"
"Well, when you say it like that, it sounds like he's got B.O. But yeah, everyone has a scent. Some are more..."
She searched for the word...
"concentrated than other people. A lot of the times I think what I smell is how they feel."
She explained about her sudden flashes of memory.
"Like I associate the scent with a memory that gives me a certain feeling, and then I know what they're feeling. It doesn't always work, because there are some things I just can't put a name to. Like, you know, a squirrel smell is a squirrel smell."
"Do I got one?"
"Yeah. You smell like leather and..."
She thought about it.
"Baby powder."
Well, leather's good. If I weren't such a manly man, I might have trouble with baby powder, though. He grinned. What about the Rev?
Opaque. Like really dense fog, or, you know, how cloudy glass has that cold smell. I couldn't really get a read on him, and then when I guessed about his, you know, touch, I could tell he was surprised, because it was like something suddenly opened up, and then I smelled rain. I think that means it was raining when it happened for him.
That, said Kincaid, is true. It was raining here that day. The glass smell is interesting, too. What do you make of it?
I think he was staring out of a window.
A smile flirted with Kincaid's mouth.
Yeah, that's true, too.
How do you know?
Because I was sitting next to him when it happened.
Where?
Where we were living, along with all the other awaken,
Kincaid said.
In the Alzheimer's wing of the hospice.
Chapter 53. Alex gaped.
You were a patient? You had Alzheimer's?
Yeah. Why do you think we're called the Awakened? I wasn't terminal, but I was close. Stage 6. Believe me, no one was more surprised than me to wake up in diapers. Thank God I was dry.
How can you joke about something like that?
All she could think of was Kincaid crapping in his pants and drooling.
I don't think that's very funny.
Kincaid hunched his shoulders in a shrug.
At my age, you learn not to take things so seriously. Anyway, I woke up in front of the picture window strapped to a wheelchair, and the tech, young fella, maybe 30, he's dead as a doornail. Try working your way out of those straps without help. Those things are geriatric straitjackets. Take a Houdini to get out of one. Near about strangled myself.
He looked at her and laughed.
You know, you don't shut that mouth of yours, you're going to be catching flies.
How many of you are there?
Awakened? Just 5, including me and the Rev.
So do you... Can you sense...
Nope, I'm just me. Besides the Rev, there's only one other person that's something similar. Hears stuff a long way off, kind of like a bat, I guess, but with nuance, which can come in handy. You're the only one can sense them, though. You're like the dogs that way, when they catch a whiff of the changed.
He favored her with that one-eyed squint.
But you, they see you as a friend. More than that, they'll protect you. So you must have changed another way, too. Pheromones, probably.
The word was familiar, something from biology.
What are those?
Chemicals made by the body that produce certain odors that trigger certain responses. As far as I know, all animals make them. So do a lot of insects. That's how bees and ants communicate, for example.
Kincaid's lips turned in a regretful grin.
I always thought my wife smelled like lilies. After she died, I hung on to her clothes for the longest time. Walking into her closet was like getting wrapped up in a hug.
She remembered how Tom had smelled, that complex spice that made her dizzy and hungry for his touch, and a hollow ache that she recognized as grief settled in her chest. Kincaid saw the look on her face and misinterpreted.
Thanks, kiddo. You never quite get over losing someone you love, but I'm okay.
He squeezed her shoulder.
Now, there's nothing we can do about the dogs deciding you're their new best friend, but we can spin the Harlan thing pretty easy. We'll just say you recognized him, okay? The Rev is right about keeping this super smell thing under wraps. Don't even tell Chris.
Don't worry about that.
She wasn't tempted to tell Chris anything. That Kincaid assumed she might confide in him was a little alarming.
Maybe they're already seeing us as a couple. Maybe that's why Jess badgered him into being my escort when he wanted to bail. Would people really try to hurt me?
It's a possibility. They might think you got some agenda. This super sense of smell thing you got going. It's a blessing and a curse. Good for us, because you might catch kids the dogs don't. And they have missed a few.
A vision of children being paraded past for her inspection floated into her mind.
I don't want to do that.
Kincaid gave her a hard look.
You're a smart girl, so don't make me spell this out for you. We need to use every advantage we got, and that includes you. But that's also where it could be a problem, because then it's your word against theirs. You can't see or touch a smell.
You guys always believe Jaeger.
Jaeger's one of the five families. He's head of the council now.
Yeah, now. But she couldn't believe they'd let some demented guy decide policy. So who had called the shots before Jaeger awakened? I wouldn't lie.
You know that, and I know that. Jaeger and the council would know. But why would regular folks trust you? If what you can do gets out, then somebody else just might decide they've got a super sense, too. In other words, they would lie. Even with the council and the Rev to say otherwise, things could get pretty nasty. See what I'm saying? We could have our own little version of the Salem witch trials, and we got no time for that kind of crap.
She had never considered this, but she could see the logic. In school, your reputation could rest on a rumor. Okay.
Good. Now, if you do sense something off, you tell me or the Rev, period. You got that?
And not any of the other council members? That was interesting. What are you going to do if someone else pops up with a super sense?
We'll deal with it then. I don't think it's as common as all that anyway. That one-eyed squint again. You got any ideas why this might have happened to you?
She felt a small flutter of alarm. No. When he said nothing, she added, Really? Kincaid's mouth screwed to a pucker.
You know, I'm not like Jaeger, but I do believe that's the first lie you've told me, Alex, and here's why. All the survivors, us older people, our brains are different, even from people who are in their 40s, 50s. Sleep patterns are way different, for one. We don't dream as much as younger people.
She thought about Tom and his broken sleep, as well as her monster and that nightmare. Would it only be sleep, then? Dreams?
A magic bullet? No. Probably a combination of things that tip the balance. Older people's brains just aren't as spry as they used to be. Our brains don't make as many neurochemicals. Now, that's not uniform. There are some very sharp 90-year-olds. I knew one, in fact. But the hell of it is, he died right away, too. Like he was 40 instead of 90.
Meaning what?
Well, let's just think about it for a second. This zap, as you call it, was a whole bunch of high-intensity EMPs, right? Well, what are those but electrical discharges? And what is the brain but an organ that relies on what is, in essence, electricity to function? A brain is like a hive of bees. All the cells have to be firing in the right order or you've got chaos. A bunch of bees going every which way and nothing getting done.
She thought she saw where he was going. So if you zap the brain with enough of a charge, you'd create chaos? Release a flood of neurochemicals? Why would that matter?
Alex, what do you think a seizure is? It's that chaos thing again. A bunch of brain cells firing in an uncoordinated manner. Plus, seizures can kill you. The brain can seize up and stop working, and the person will die. So what I'm thinking is that older people, whose brains already don't work as well as when they were younger, were protected. They got knocked for a loop when the zap hit, but they didn't die. Those of us who were bad off, the awakened, our brains were like little raisins. So for us, the zap kind of woke us up, primed our brains to make chemicals we'd been missing. I think it's probably more complicated than that, but you get the general idea.
She did, but that still didn't answer why Tom had lived, or her, unless she was right about the monster having done enough damage to save her. But then, what about kids?
Don't know. Kids' brains aren't set in stone. They're still growing and developing. I know for a fact that kids can survive brain injuries, like cold water drownings, that would kill or cripple an adult. The older you get, the less able your brain is to absorb an injury and adapt. I guess there's just a natural cutoff where the injury gets to be too much for the brain to handle. In the context of the zap, that means the majority of adults couldn't absorb the trauma, and they flat out died.
What about the change?
Based on what we've seen, I think it's got to do with brain development and hormones.
Tom and I wondered the same thing.
She told Kincaid about meeting Larry and Deirdre.
Kincaid bobbed his head in a nod.
That fits. Hormones would also explain why kids are still changing as they get older.
Her thoughts darted to Ellie.
You mean every little kid is going to change?
Maybe. So far, that looks to be true. On the other hand, it's only been a couple of months, and so maybe whatever changed in their brains will repair itself. The really young ones, babies and toddlers, kindergartners, they might have a chance, but maybe not.
A whole generation of kids changing. The thought sent a shiver down her spine. But then why have some of us changed and not others?
The spared? I don't know what's going on with you all. Why you and people like Chris and Peter and this Tom of yours didn't change. Your brains are probably different somehow, but I'll be damned if I know.
She hesitated a moment.
You said that old people's sleep and dreams are different. I think something bad happened to Tom in Afghanistan, enough so he didn't sleep much, and never for very long.
Kincaid's eyebrows arched.
Post-traumatic stress. I never thought of that. Could be, though.
Why?
Because the brains of people with PTSD show permanent changes, and the symptoms reinforce the damage, and then the damage means more symptoms. That's why PTSD is so hard to treat. People can learn to function, but it's an injury the brain just never recovers from.
Kincaid huffed out a silent laugh like a dog.
If I wasn't just a country doctor and got a big enough sample of kids and had a fancy laboratory and could do all kinds of tests, maybe I'd figure it out. But that's not ever happening. One thing I do know, though, all of us awakened, we got some kind of brain damage by definition. And now I'm thinking that some of the older kids who should have changed didn't, because their brains and hormones were somehow different.
He paused.
You see where I'm going with this, right?
Her stomach tightened in a sudden twist of fear.
Not really.
Alex, I may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I am a doctor, and I can put two and two together. The Rev had bad brain damage, and he's got a super sense. We got another awakened with super hearing. But you are the only kid I know who's both spared and got a super sense. So, Alex, I got to know,
Kincaid said with his best one-eyed squint.
What exactly is living in that head of yours?
Chapter 54.
Are you okay?
Sarah said. She halted as ghosts snuffled around a tree.
You've been really quiet all night. Just tired.
Alex hunched her shoulders as the wind forked up a fistful of icy snow and sent it whirling in a sparkling arabesque in the light of their torch. She could see the bulky silhouette of their guard a few steps ahead, and the flash of snow splintering the harsh white light of his lantern.
"I'm really sorry about what happened,"
Sarah said.
"Happened?" "Yes. At the courthouse? That's all over town. About how you recognized that man, Harlan. Peter told me that Harlan left that little girl alone out there."
"Ellie." "Yeah," Alex said, a little ashamed now because she'd not been thinking about Ellie, but Kincaid. He might call himself a country doctor, but he was sharp enough to guess about the monster. She supposed she could have lied. There was no way Kincaid could look inside her brain, after all. But telling him had been kind of a relief. What he'd said about the monster was interesting, too.
"You don't know that the tumor's gone, or dead, or dormant. Maybe the zap shorted it out. Or maybe all those EMPs organized it somehow, made it functional instead of destructive, like another lobe of your brain."
"Or maybe both." She recalled how sick, chemo-sick, she'd felt right after the attacks. She'd assumed the zap caused that, but her brain was chock full of pebbles loaded with a new and experimental drug. Barrett hadn't been able to get the pebbles to dump their payload. The light probes hadn't worked. But light was just a visible form of electromagnetic radiation, a different kind of EMP. So maybe the zap from all those EMPs was strong enough to trigger the pebbles. The monster had either died or altered in some way, and so had she. She could share none of this with Sarah.
It's okay. I mean, it's not. I understand why Chris didn't want to go after Ellie, but...
She let out a breath that the wind stole.
Doesn't make it feel any better.
Sarah was quiet as they waited for Ghost to finish.
I think they're doing the best they can, she said finally. You know, to give us homes and stuff. That's not the same as being happy or free. People did try to kill you, Sarah pointed out. I'll bet a bunch of them would kill all of us if they could.
Larry, you're an endangered species.
Yeah, but then who'd be left? Lena's right. They need us. I mean, have you seen some of these guys? They're really old. Eventually, they're going to, you know, break down. They need us to take care of them. Well, said Sarah, I don't know if that's the only...
There came the sudden distant stutter of gunfire. The shots were very quick, nearly overlapping.
Rifles,
Alex thought. Ghost flinched, tried to scurry between Alex's legs, and only succeeded in winding his leash around her calves. At the end of the block, she saw their guard hurrying back to them. You girls about done? He asked. His own dog, a long-haired mutt, swished around Alex, and then stood patiently as the puppy nipped at the other dog's neck and did the I'm so thrilled to see you squiggle.
Who are they shooting at? Asked Alex.
The guard simultaneously shrugged his shoulders and shook his head. Could be some changed, but they don't bother us much anymore. 10-1, it's raiders. Nights when they try to come in through the woods. Stupid, you ask me.
Why? Asked Alex. Because they come out at night, too, Sarah said.
Double the risk, double your fun, said the guard, doing the cold man's two-step. We got our perimeter, which means they got to make it through the zone, avoid the changed, and slip in through the perimeter without us catching them. Only way to do that is to come out by day, hunker down in the zone, and wait. Ones we don't get at night, we get come daylight. Well, that answered the question of the shots Alex had heard that morning. The image of Rule's guards combing the woods to pick off strays bothered her. She bet Peter wouldn't have a problem with it. Would Chris? Was he out there now?
So what if he is? She felt a nip of impatience. Who cares what Chris thinks or where he is? Still, the thought nagged at her, and what made her even angrier was what she felt when she pictured Chris taking risks out there in the dark. Worried.
Back at the house, Jess was sewing by candlelight and seemed unconcerned. Alex figured she was probably used to the nightly gunfight at the OK Corral. She and Sarah said goodnight to Jess, and the guard, who seemed happy enough to thaw out by the wood stove. That dog stays downstairs, Jess said when Ghost tried following Alex. She handed Alex and Sarah red rubber hot water bottles and a lit candle, then bent to scoop up the puppy. Oh, aren't you a brute, she scolded, and then laughed as the puppy's tongue darted for her chin. He'll be fine in his bed down here. If you girls want to double up, though, you might be warmer.
Said Alex, and glanced at Sarah, who shrugged. It's okay with me, said Sarah.
Good. You should both stay in Alex's room, then. It's right over the kitchen, said Jess. Pushing through the anvil of cold air, solidly wedged on the stairs, was an act of will. It was so cold, their breath steamed in the light of the single candle Jess had given them. Tori's bedroom door was closed. A towel-covered tray of food was still squared before Lena's door. When she'd come back after her job at the laundry, Alex didn't envy Lena one bit, Lena had gone straight upstairs and refused to come down. Crouching, Sarah peeked under the towel.
She hasn't touched it, she whispered. She'll just bite your head off. Come on, she'll eat when she's hungry,
Alex hissed back, thinking only of diving beneath the covers. Even with the hot water bottle tucked around her feet, there was no way she was sleeping without socks and long johns. Sarah lingered a moment longer, then followed. After they'd washed, the icy water gave Alex brain freeze when she brushed her teeth, then swiftly changed and crawled under a double feather quilt. Sarah whispered,
"She's really not so bad, you know."
"What?" Being in bed with Sarah had dredged up thoughts of Ellie, and Alex had to think a second.
"Who, Lena?
Only if you don't mind permanent PMS."
"She had it really rough before. She doesn't talk about it much."
"Did she really run away from here?"
"Yeah, about 3 weeks after she got here. She was trying to go back up north. I think she's still got family up near Oren."
Amish country, she thought, remembering the sign she'd seen months ago at that Quick Mart.
Wow. Like, how old? Old enough to be dead? Young enough to be changed? Her mom's dead for sure. I think her dad died years ago. She said that she, her mom, and a couple brothers were living with her grandparents. They might be alive.
Then how'd she end up here if she still had family?
I never asked, but I don't think she liked home much. Anyway, when she ran, she only got about a mile into the zone.
Zone? The guard had said that too.
Yeah, like buffer zone, the cushion between rule and everybody else. The dogs caught her. That's another reason she hates them so much.
A mile's still pretty far. That means she had to slip an escort, too.
Well, she got pretty friendly with the guards. I think she bribed one by, you know.
No, I... And then she got it.
Oh, that's just gross. Some of these guys are gross, Sarah said matter-of-factly. They only look like grandpas. Anyway, that's why Jess always has to be around when the older guys come in. If a guy our age visits, though, she leaves so we can, you know, talk and stuff. They want us to get to know those guys.
What happened to the guard that Lena, you know?
They banned him, like they did with that guy you recognized. And people just nicely decide not to sneak back in? I guess when they know they'll be shot, they decide not to.
No way.
Way? Reverend Yeager's really strict about it. Like, once he's decided you're banned, that's it. There are a lot of guards in the woods.
Like, walking around? She wasn't sure she'd want to be out there after dark, even with a rifle. Sarah shook her head.
Tree stands. You have to know where to look. Even then, they move around, so you can't predict where they'll be.
You know a lot about this.
Oh, well, Peter and I are... We talk.
The way Sarah said that, Alex thought they maybe did a lot more than just talk, in which case Tori was in for a major disappointment.
So what do you have to do to get permission to leave?
Asked Alex.
Why would anyone want to?
Well, Alex said, momentarily flustered, what if you want to try and find family or something? I mean, if I wanted to.
Oh, we'll never get permission. They got us, they're going to keep us.
Rule, Alex thought, was like a commercial for an insecticide. Roaches check in, but they don't check out.
And you're okay with that? Well, sure, said Sarah. I mean, it's not like we've got a ton of choices.
That made her think of something Lena had mentioned that made no sense.
Is that what they mean by chosen? Like, is it the same as spared? No. Chosen means that someone picks you.
Picks you?
Yeah.
A pause.
A guy.
A guy?
Yeah. A guy, you know, decides that he wants, you know.
What? Alex said, much louder than she intended.
They give us to a guy? To go live with him? Yeah, but not with any of the old ones, Sarah said reasonably. They give us to guys our age. One of them picks one of us, and if the council says it's okay, then we go live with him. We get our own house, which is way better than here. Anyway, the idea is we live together and get to know each other.
She paused.
It's like that old Amish thing, you know, bundling. Only we get to live together, not just get in the same bed.
Neither sounded good.
Are you serious? You're serious. Are we? If a guy picks us, do they expect us to, you know, sleep with him? If we want to, I guess. It would be normal. Not right away, of course.
Sarah faltered.
No one's supposed to force us, but sure. I mean, that's what people living together do.
No, that's what people in love do. Even if they lock you in some guy's house, they can't make you feel that way.
And they've done this to some girls already? It's only been a couple of months.
She felt Sarah nod.
I think they were doing it before for a real long time. All I know is no one's asked to go back. The council says you can if you want to, but no one has. I mean, think about it. You get your own house. You make up your own rules. Well, pretty much. It's not like you get to go wherever you want, but it's not safe outside rule anyway, so who cares?
My God, no matter what Kincaid said, it was like a cult.
So no one has ever refused? Well, I think Lena was worried that this one guy was going to ask.
Sarah sighed.
It was Peter, okay? I thought Tori liked Peter.
Tori? A snort.
Peter is so not interested. Greg's got this complete crush on her, though. It's kind of embarrassing, you know? Like a seventh grader asking out a senior. So what happened with Lena and Peter? He started hanging around a lot and asking to walk her places, you know.
Like a date?
About as close as you get to one in rule, yeah. I think that's how she figured out which guard was working where. After they brought her back, Peter was so mad he wanted her banned, but you'd have to pretty much murder someone for that to happen to one of us, and even then I'm not sure the Reverend would do it. We're really valuable.
What if we say no?
Well, I wouldn't say no to Peter,
Sarah said.
And if you're smart, you won't say no to Chris, either.
Chapter 55 Sarah fell asleep soon after. Alex stared into the shadows on the ceiling, her brain going like a runaway train. She had been so stupid. How could she not have seen this? This was why people kept saying that she and every other girl was so valuable, because a girl could be paired up with a guy. Hell, the way things were going, maybe a girl would end up paired with more than one. Because they were valuable. Because they could make babies. It really was the end of the world as she had known it. Rule wasn't a sanctuary. It was a prison. But Sarah was wrong. Alex had not one, not two, but three choices. One, she could go along with the rules and hope that some guy who wasn't totally gross picked her, maybe Chris for that matter. Two, she could make some noise. Her father had trained her well. She was easily as good a shot as any of the guys on patrol, and maybe better than some. Riding couldn't be that tough, so she could get herself assigned to a patrol. She did have something to offer, after all, and her super sense, if, say, she told Chris or Peter, would come in handy. She wasn't exactly sure what she'd do if she actually had to shoot someone who wasn't changed. On the other hand, if she ran into another Harlan, that might not be such a problem. Anyway, the point was to get out of rule. So once she'd been on a couple patrols and they loosened up, she could just ride on out and not come back. Three, she could grab her parents' ashes and run like hell, which would, as it happened, be pretty much coming full circle, picking up where she'd left off when this whole nightmare started. The first option completely creeped her out. She didn't want to be given away to anyone. And making babies? She couldn't think about that without her skin getting all crawly. And where it would stop? There was no guarantee she'd end up with anyone she even liked. Men made the decisions in rule. Jess was a strong woman. For all Alex knew, these were some of the things Jess wanted Chris to change. Yet despite all her bluster, Jess bowed to the will of the men. Either way, option one was a complete non-starter. The second option was a possibility. If she got herself assigned to a patrol, she could figure the best way to get the hell out of here. They couldn't keep her glued to one of them forever. Eventually, they would have to trust her. She could picture it. Out on horseback, and one of them, Chris, would say, "You check over there, I'll check here." By the time he thought to look for her, she would be gone. So how to get on patrol? She had to talk to someone. Peter? Yeah, Peter would like that she knew guns. Maybe she could even tell him about her spidey sense? Yeah, but how would she demonstrate something like that? Kincaid had believed her because he was one of the Awakened, and he knew about Jaeger's super sense. But if no one else knew... Kincaid had said it was subjective, no way to prove that what she said was the truth unless she fingered someone. Chris. She didn't know about him. She might be able to work on him, but it wasn't like she was all that experienced, and playing up to Chris made her uneasy, and not just because she didn't want to encourage this whole Tarzan-Jane thing. With Peter, what you saw was what you got. Chris lived too much in the shadows, and she had this sense that he was always watching her, watching for her, trying to figure her out. And what would Chris do if he knew about her? Bad enough that Kincaid had guessed about the monster. Not even Jaeger had put that together. The Rev seemed to accept her ability as an act of God kind of thing. Wow, wait a minute. If Chris or Peter found out about the monster, she bet either, both, would figure they could trade her for someone who might, you know, live. They'd dropkick her out of town if they knew about the monster, and wasn't that what she wanted? Well, yeah, but not like that. When she left, she wanted it to be on her terms, when she was ready. For that, she would need supplies. Enough for a month, she figured, and that meant MREs, mostly. 3 days' worth of trail mix and an egg salad sandwich just wouldn't cut it. She'd need bleach to purify water, or tablets, a sleeping bag, a tarp, water bottles. Her busy mind ticked over the items. Flint, waterproof matches, snare wire, lint for tinder. She would have to make a list. She still had the boot knife Tom had given her. In all the fuss, they'd overlooked that. She'd squirreled the knife beneath her mattress first, then thought that was too obvious, so she hid the knife where she thought no one would think to look, in Ghost's bag of dog food, all the way at the bottom. Just so long as she kept an eye on his kibbles, she was golden. But she would need a gun. Her Glock, if she could find it again, and a rifle would be good. Ammunition, several bricks, if she could find out where they kept all that. Maybe a bow? No, too big. Same thing with a rifle, but a gun for sure, without question, and a place to hide everything until she got herself on a patrol. But which way to run? Lena. Lena had tried. Lena would know, would have a rough idea anyway. Yeah, but Lena wasn't stupid. If Alex started nosing around asking questions, Lena would put it together. Lena would want in, and that was a recipe for disaster. Once she ran, how long would they try to find her? Maybe only as long as they figured she was worth keeping. Which brought her around to full disclosure about the monster, and that was no good. Bringing her around to door number 3. Just cut and run. Soon. If she could lie low for a couple weeks, play along while she got stuff together, she might pull it off. No need to get herself put on patrol. In fact, it might be better if she hung around town, figured out its rhythms and who went where, get people to trust her and see her as a familiar figure. The familiar was usually invisible. How many people really noticed everything they saw? Plus, Rule needed supplies. For that, they would need Chris and Peter and a bunch of guys, a bunch of horses, a bunch of wagons, and men to ride as escort, like the old wagon trains. That might be the time to boogie, when a lot of the guys were out of town and everyone else was covering their butts. Carefully, she eased out of bed, wincing at every squeak of the bedsprings, but Sarah was deep asleep and didn't stir. Crossing to the window, she slid a finger between the curtains and peered out. She heard the soft patter of snow against glass, but saw nothing. The night was deep and dark and vast, with no street lights or bob of a flashlight or even a helpful cigarette. She could only guess where the guard kept himself, and he probably moved around, if only to stay warm. It occurred to her that she didn't know if they had a kind of shelter or guard box, which would make the most sense. Hanging out in a snowstorm couldn't be good for any person, even a younger guy her age, and she couldn't imagine some poor schnook hunkering down all night on the porch with a rifle in his lap. It was more likely that there were mounted patrols, like cops in New York City. She would have to find out. And what about the dogs? Crap. If she happened to pass by, and she would, there was no help for that, they would give her away. She was every dog's best friend. Taking Ghost with her was one thing, but having an entire pack? Yeah, but could she use that somehow? She flashed to an image of assembling an army of dogs. Go, fetch, play dead. Not bloody likely, as Aunt Hannah would say. The cold seeped through the glass and broke over her face. She thought of herself out there, alone, struggling through drifts. Even with snowshoes and skis, it would be hard going. Her window of opportunity was closing, and fast. Winter would only get worse. So, how to avoid getting caught, or worse, being mistaken for a raider and shot? Maybe duck out the southwest corner, hightail it for the old mine, then loop back north and head... where? Minnesota? The border? Canada? If Tom was still alive, that's where he'd go. A lot of ground to cover, and a big country besides. But if Tom was alive... if Tom was alive... Tom... She exhaled his name in a soft whisper, watching as her breath fogged the window, and then slowly cleared, leaving only a memory that there'd been anything there at all. Saying his name brought on that hollow ache again. If Tom wasn't dead, where was he? What had happened to him? Was he looking for her? No, he'd have gotten here by now. He knew she was going to rule. But if he was alive, and he was thinking about her at the same moment she was thinking about him, maybe... She closed her eyes. She forced herself to be very still, wrestled her thoughts to gray, and yet opened her memory to his smell. That strange and spicy scent that was Tom. She saw and felt him in flashes. Tom in the light of the fire. Tom as he held her the night they found the radio. Tom as a silhouette keeping watch over her. Tom's lips. Tom's hand in her hair. His taste. She didn't know if the tightness in her throat or the fullness in her heart meant that he was there, that they were connected somehow. Maybe all that she saw and felt was the sensual fullness of memory, that which abided and was nothing but the ghost of a touch, the whisper of a word, the lingering of a scent. But she felt him just the same, and thought that maybe this was why some people didn't mind being haunted. Chapter 56. By morning, she'd decided that for the time being she would follow the rules. Recon, that's what Tom would have called it. Work with Kincaid at the hospice, which doubled as Rules Hospital. Learn who went where, get her bearings, gather supplies, and then, when the time was right, get herself gone. School was a joke. She was way more advanced than her teachers could handle, and by lunchtime of the first day, the principal figured she might as well spend all her time with Kincaid. Chris was waiting in the hall outside the principal's office to escort her to the hospice. He and the principal exchanged greetings, and then the principal said, "Chris, think you can scare up a few more copies of Robinson Crusoe? Say 10? Oh, also Island of the Blue Dolphins, anything by Cleary or Dahl?" As they headed for the front door of the church, Alex said, "You can really find those?" "Probably not." Chris held the door, then followed her out into the cold. The sun was shining for a change. Squinting, he rooted around in a breast pocket, pulled out a pair of aviator sunglasses, and slid them on. Alex felt a quick sting of envy. The sun was bright enough to hurt, and she put up a hand to block the glare.
He said,
"You don't have sunglasses?"
"I did," she said with faint annoyance. She wasn't stupid. "They were in my pack."
"Sorry," he said. "I wasn't criticizing."
"No big deal."
Recon, she thought.
"So where do you get books?"
"Some in town, but the closest library's 3-4 days out, so that's not really an option. Too many men and wagons tied up to make it worthwhile. Most of the houses for 20 miles around have been cleaned out already, if they haven't gone up in flames."
She unclipped Honey's lead, then swung into the saddle. The snow came halfway to Honey's knees. She would have to trade up for a larger horse soon. Either that or just ski to the hospice, which might be a way of getting skis, come to think of it, and maybe a pair of snowshoes.
"Yeah, I saw that. Burned out houses. I don't get it."
Chris guided his blood bay, Knight, and fell in alongside as they crossed the village green before taking a side street north toward the hospice. Raiders, mostly. People who take what they can, then torch the rest. They're not as organized or big as we are, or they'd have taken over rule by now. But what they're doing is kind of an interesting strategy.
"Why?"
He regarded her from behind his dark glasses. "Burn out more people. They head here. Word gets around. The more people we take in, the farther out we're forced to go to find things. The farther from rule we have to go, the easier we are to pick off. That's why we limit who we take in. But even so, we're taking more risks now than before, traveling days sometimes to find what we need. Things might get easier once we can plant again, but until then we're as dependent as everyone else on what we can scavenge."
"Is that what happened last night? Raiders tried to get into town?"
He nodded. "We lost 3 men.
"What about the raiders?"
"Got 2, but 2 got away. Next time I'm following them. I don't care what Peter says. If we could follow them to their camp or town or wherever, we could finish them off and take what they've found. One less group to worry about, and more for us."
"But they're not changed. They're just people trying to survive, Chris."
"Who are trying to take what we've got."
"If you talk to them, maybe cooperated?"
"There's no talking with these guys."
"How do you know that? Have you tried?"
When he didn't reply, she pressed,
"Chris, you can't just go around killing people and taking what they have."
"Why not?" He kept his shuttered eyes on the road. "They'd kill us if they got the chance."
The hospice was small, 4 wings, 60 beds, and only 20 of those occupied by true hospice patients. Most were in the terminal stages of cancer or lung disease.
"Miners, a lot of them," Kincaid said as they stopped outside a day room. "We're just trying to make them comfortable." She swept her eyes over the scatter of patients, old men, mostly, with portable green oxygen tanks, slumped in overstuffed chairs. Most were dozing, although some played checkers or chess. A few shuffled greasy cards for games of solitaire. The sight depressed her, and the smell of antiseptic soap brought back too many memories, all of them bad. She turned to see Kincaid's eyes on her.
"You won't be working here much," he said. "We got dedicated hospice staff still around for this."
"It's okay,"
she said, although she was relieved. She could too easily see herself here. Back when the only thing she'd had to worry about was, imminent death, she'd visited a few hospices for people her age and thought that waiting around to die with strangers was even nuttier than waiting around to die at Aunt Hannah's.
"How are you getting your tanks?"
"The way we get everything."
He started off down the hall, motioning for her to follow.
"Either the guys out foraging bring 'em back, or they don't. Right now, mostly they don't. If it's a choice between our guys grabbing a wagon load of antibiotics and bandages versus a couple oxygen tanks, it's not a contest."
"What are you going to do when you run out of supplies?"
Alex asked. Foraging was all well and good, but there had to be limits to what they could stockpile. Judging from the nightly rifle fire, Kincaid must see his share of wounded.
"Triage," Kincaid said briefly, like that explained something.
She knew the word. Her mother had worked the emergency room. But sorting the wounded by category didn't answer anything, unless... She stared up at Kincaid. What happens when someone's really, you know, shot up pretty bad? She didn't want to say when someone can't be saved or when someone's going to die. Kincaid held her eyes a moment.
If you're smart enough to ask that question, you already know the answer.
She did. Chris had said it. When there was only so much to go around, you did the math. Treat the ones who were either most likely to survive or valuable in some way. The rest, you had to hope the end came fast. She wondered if Kincaid helped those people along. Given the situation, she thought he just might. Kincaid had two other assistants, both older men in their late 60s who'd been nurses, but in retirement before. There were six techs, a fancy name for people like her who did things like mop up blood, change sheets, empty bedpans, bring meals. When he saw the look on her face, Kincaid laughed.
Don't worry. When the patrols start coming back, someone's usually hurt. That's where you're gonna cut your teeth.
True to his word, Kincaid had her assist when a farmer hobbled in a few hours later. The farmer had laid his thigh open almost to his knee.
Damn saw jumped and bit me.
The wound was very deep, and Kincaid kept her busy irrigating away blood as he worked. Halfway through, when the bleeding was mostly under control and he'd put in the first few stitches, he handed her the Kelly clamp and tissue forceps and said,
"You been watching? Good. Now I want you to throw a couple stitches in that muscle there. Don't be shy, just do it."
He watched as she threw in and tied off the first stitch, and then he nodded.
"That was good. You done this before?"
"My mom was a doctor."
She could hear her mother's voice in her head.
"Roll your wrist, sweetie. Don't be afraid to take a big bite."
"We practiced on chicken legs. She said it was closest to what sewing up people was like."
"Jeez, remind me not to come over for dinner," said the farmer.
She tagged after Kincaid until well past dark, and when she walked out of the building, Chris was there with Honey, which was only a little freaky.
How had he known?
It wasn't as if someone could just pick up a cell. Was he keeping tabs on her? If so, that wasn't good. Compared to that morning, they didn't talk much. Nothing more than, "Hi, how are you? Just peachy, that's good." That was fine. Once they were on Jess's street, a cul-de-sac, he dismounted, waited while she stabled Honey in the garage at the end of the block, and then walked her to Jess's house. She said good night and thanks, he nodded and said nothing, and that was that, which was fine. Chris showed up the second day, but not the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth. Instead, Greg escorted her and pumped her about Tori. Unlike Chris, Greg was both chatty and sloppy, which was how she figured out where supplies, backpacks, food, clothes, were cached back in the village. And also that the southwest corner was the least heavily patrolled.
"We even got a couple gas depots," Greg said. "We've been siphoning gas from cars and trucks and stuff. Figure to use it for the tractors, chainsaws, stuff like that come spring."
"Why not use the gas now?" she asked. "Wouldn't some snowmobiles work?"
"Sure, and we would in an emergency. But no one's going to be making any more gasoline for a long, long time. Once we use up our stockpiles, that's it. We might figure a way to pump gas up from the tanks under stations, but we need an engineer to help us with that. Even if we can get at the gas, we still have the problem of eventually running out, and it's kind of spooky anyway, you know? The noise. Anyway, the council's into us being self-sufficient and simpler, like the Amish, which we already kind of were before the, you know... That's why so many of the houses have hand pumps and stuff for water. Without those, we'd have been completely screwed."
With that logic, Alex thought, Peter and Chris and everyone else ought to wear deerskins, give up guns, and take up bows and arrows, or clubs.
"What about the people you turn away? You don't just throw them out with nothing, do you?"
Greg's forehead crinkled in alarm.
"Oh, no, that would be, like, wrong. They get... You know, a backpack and some supplies, couple days' worth of food, water."
"What about guns? They'd need those too, won't they?
Yeah, but... Greg scrunched up his nose. They'd probably shoot us, right?
Good point.
She inclined her head at his rifle. Nice.
It's a Henry, isn't it?
Greg beamed. Yeah, it's sweet. Big boy. 44 Magnum. The scope is completely awesome. I also got me a Bushmaster M4 for patrol. We got, like, this arsenal.
Cool. Where?
Well, we all got a couple guns at home, but most we lock up in the village hall, down in the basement below the jail. Keep the ammo there, too. It's about the safest place in town. Well, that wasn't good. She couldn't think of a decent excuse that would get her into the basement so she could steal some ammo, or past a locked door, for that matter. So that meant she would have to steal a weapon from someone's house. Did Jess have a gun? No, being a girl, probably not. One of the guys, then. Or maybe Kincaid. She'd figure it out. She had to. Sunday was church. The council sat in tall chairs ranged on the pulpit while the Rev led worship, early and mid-morning, and everyone attended one service or the other. Of course, Jess had Alex and the other girls go to both, which was a drag. The service was pretty much what she expected. A couple readings, a bunch of songs, a sermon, more songs, and then go forth and be numbered among the righteous. Yeager's was mostly Brave New World stuff, about how much darker than darkness the world could be, and how God could permit such suffering, blah blah. Along with Revelations and Gaul and Star Wormwood, the Rev also seemed overly fond of brother stories, Jacob and Esau, Ishmael and Isaac, Cain and Abel. For the Rev, the changed bore the mark of Cain, the wickedness of Ishmael, the hard primitiveness of Esau. Cain was a no-brainer, but from what she remembered, Jacob tricked his dad, and Abraham couldn't keep his pants zipped. How any of that reflected on either Esau, who was just a hairy, hard-working farmer looking for a meal, or poor Ishmael, whose only crime seemed to have been being born, she didn't know. Judging from the stony look Jess gave the Rev when he started in on his brother rant, the way her scent, so white and black,